Sports Arena. This is Portland Wrestling.
And this is the Portland WrestleCast. I'm Jim Valley. You know, now that I'm feeling better and to have more energy, the plan is to get the Portland WrestleCast back up on a more regular basis. Of all the shows that I do, the WrestleCast takes the most as far as preparation, research, production, lining up guests. It's a very labor-intensive show. I'm trying to streamline it and do the best I can, and the hope is that there'll be more coming on a more regular basis in the very near future. You know, I always end the show with the phrase, "There's excitement in the air," which was the catchphrase of the late, great Lonnie Mane. Lonnie Mane died right as I was starting to become a wrestling fan. I have some very vague early memories of Lonnie Mane. But because it's on YouTube and the last remnants of Portland wrestling are still out there, people always remember Roddy Piper, Buddy Rose, Rip Oliver, the Grappler. And don't get me wrong, they should. The hair match between Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper was the biggest one-night payoff in Don Owens history, but the Expo Center, where the match was held, only had a capacity of about 6,000 people. If you talk to locals of a generation a little older than me, there are two names synonymous with Portland wrestling: Lonnie Mane and Tough Tony Bourne. You're probably familiar with his son, Matt Bourne, who was Doink the Clown and Big Josh, and while not as well-known to maybe modern fans, Tough Tony Bourne was probably a bigger name and a bigger draw than his son. He traveled the world, he was a great heel in Mexico against people like Blue Demon, and when he retired and went into real estate, Tony said there wasn't a day that went by where someone didn't mention Lonnie Mane. In the late 60s, they ruled the Northwest. Of course, Tough Tony Bourne had been here since the 50s. And, you know, in the 60s, both of them wrestled and beat the likes of Pat Patterson, Ray Stevens, Luther Lindsay, Stan Stasiak, Pepper Martin, Paul Jones, and many more. In 1968, they were not only Northwest Tag Team Champions, but the San Francisco version of the World Tag Team Champions. And when they lost the belts, things went downhill as far as the team goes. But business was great as they main evented the Portland Memorial Coliseum three times in 1968, drawing 8,000, 7,000, and 5,000 people respectively. Not bad considering the population of Portland was around 800,000 people. Now, you'd think it'd be easy to find people who remember this huge match and this feud and its details. But apparently, not if you're me. I've talked to Tony Bourne's daughter, that shows in the archives, talked to historians, wrestlers, and everyone that I've talked to is very vague on this feud, which is strange, because from what I can tell, and from many people, it's probably the biggest feud in Portland wrestling history. Well, it turns out the answers were right in front of me the whole time. All I had to do was listen to one of my favorite podcasts, John McAdam's Stick to Wrestling podcast. He had my friend on, Frank Culbertson. They touched briefly on this feud, but not all of it. So what I want to do is bring on my friend Frank Culbertson and talk about the biggest feud in Portland wrestling history: Tough Tony Bourne against Lonnie Mane. And joining me now is former Portland wrestling promoter, that's the incarnation from the mid-2000s, and longtime Portland wrestling fan, Frank Culbertson. My friend, Frank, how long have I known you? I'm going to say 99-2000.
Absolutely true.
So I've known you 20-some years now. So the other day, I'm listening to the Stick to Wrestling podcast with John McAdams. Great guy, great podcast. And you're on there talking about the book, which we'll get to in a second. And I had no idea. I've known you 20 years, and I did not know that you were at the Portland Coliseum for the Tough Tony Bourne Lonnie Main match. How? I felt like a lousy friend that we've never had that conversation.
I'm sure I put it out there somewhere, but you know, I have to keep a little bit of mystery about me, Jim.
I couldn't believe, because I've interviewed Toni Rayborn, Matt's sister, Tony's daughter. She mm-hmm. she had very vague memories of it. You know, it's a very good book. Stephen Verrier's book on Northwest Wrestling is very good. I would encourage people to read it. However, it is nothing on this match. I mean, this is a gaping hole in Northwest history for a Northwest Wrestling history book not to have in it. And I've asked other fans and things, and people are always vague. And then here's this guy that I know really well who was right frickin' there, and I did not even know.
Well, you know, and it was I only went to the first. There was three matches at the Coliseum within a short period of time, and right. I was at the very first one. My grandfather, Grandpa Culbertson, and my dad took me to wrestling frequently, and this is one of my earliest memories of my second earliest memory, probably, of wrestling was Maine versus Bourne at the Coliseum. I was, you know, like 9 years old, so almost 10, so pretty young, but really at the start of when I started following wrestling, especially Portland wrestling, because back in those days, you really didn't see other wrestling other than your local stuff.
Well, this is perfect that you were 9 to 10, because as my friend Howard Baum always says, nothing is cooler than when you're 10 years old. So you're the perfect age, the perfect person to talk to about.
It's my favorite years for wrestling, like 68 through 70. And in baseball, it's late 80s through early, mid 70s, probably because you're young and still naive to some things, or were back then. And so everything seems so important and so vital in your life. And wrestling was that way for sure.
Then you get older and realize nothing matters.
except relationships and integrity and, as you know, health.
That's
glad to see that
right.
You're up and about.
At least we're doing the best we can. So
that's right.
Frank played a role in Mike Rogers' new book. It's called Katie Bar the Door, The History of Portland Wrestling. Did you help chronicle a lot of this and kind of put it together?
So Mike would send me results listed out and then some of the narrative. And then it was my job to put it together, format it, source the pictures, correct editing and grammar, run it through a number of programs that I have for editing and format it so that it would come out as a finished product. I would bet it was, for me, easy, 100 hours of editing and sourcing. So if I didn't love wrestling, I probably would have quit after 10 hours. But it was a lot of fun, and it brought back so many memories of things that Mike wrote about or results that came through. So it was well worth it. It's a great book, whether you remember the 60s and 70s or you're a fan of the 80s through the end in 1991. It's a book that people will love. People who have bought it enjoy it because it brings back so many memories of a critical time in people's lives and when they were kids.
Yeah, it reads.
Or young adults.
It's got results and then narratives in between to kind of bridge the gaps between different shows, different matches, setting the stage, various feuds, who's in, who's out, and oftentimes why behind the scenes. So it's a great reference book for people. You know, as I was reading through it, preparing to talk to you, and then I'll do an interview with Mike later, but I wanted to do you first because Mike wants to talk more about the 70s. So I figured I'd do you in chronological order. But as I'm reading it, if you didn't know You know, Portland has this reputation for being a second-rate promotion. It's small time. Wasn't that big. The money wasn't that great. If you were just looking at the results and all the stars that came through, you'd think you were reading the history of Georgia wrestling or something like that. Looking at the results and the people that come in and out, this is a major promotion.
Absolutely. That's one of the great things about the book is you see somebody that, like a Rene Goulet, who people don't think was here, or Brooklyn Brawler, Steve Lombardi, who was here for just a week. People that you would never think about having come through Portland, and even the bigger stars, like Buddy Rogers, who defended the NWA title here. People who remember the 80s, 90s, would never know that unless they had this book and were reading it. So that's what's really exciting about it. And when you look back, even in the 60s, you get a history of a person that people remember, like Shag Thomas as the larger-than-life referee who wore the Leprinzi's T-shirt that always got ripped by the heels, and he was always the enforcer. But he had a tremendous career in Portland, was a 15-time tag team champion with a number of individuals, was a great wrestler, especially for his size, tagged with Luther Lindsay, who, you know, is a shooter himself. So the people that came through back in the 60s and 70s, they were the who's who of wrestling around the world.
Yeah, I mean, Pat Patterson, Nick Bockwinkel, Ray Stevens, so many people came through the Northwest, Stan Stasiak.
Pepper Martin, John Tolos, Don Leo.
Billy Whitewolf.
Don Leo, who was in the very first match I ever saw live against Stan Stasiak, about a year and a half before the main Bourne match. Don Leo was, you know, a giant in the wrestling business, literally and figuratively. Yeah.
But I wanted to talk about something. I mean, this is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest feud in the history of Portland wrestling. And in some ways, it's forgotten, which seems unfortunate. So hopefully we can teach people about it and give it a little bit more light as it gets older and older. But one thing I want to talk about before we get into it is kind of set the stage. Back in the 60s, Portland was only 800,000 people, plus or minus. Not a huge city.
Correct.
And it was also a logging area. Northwest was Weyerhaeuser. It was timber. Talk about what it was like growing up in the Northwest.
Sure. Every time you would go to the beach, one of the things you had to watch out for was the logging trucks, because they were all over the place. And we're not talking a few. They were literally coming up behind you all the time at a high rate of speed. That's what Don Owen would lament about all the time, was, oh, the end of the logging. And he was going out of business. He said that for years and years, every single week. But Portland was different. And, you know, the growth that has happened all the way from Portland out through what used to be way out in Sandy is now just homes all the way through. But Portland was, Portland had growing pains early and continues to have growing pains. But I've been here all 64 years of my life, and it's still a great place to live. Portland, I would say Portland's interesting when you talk about where Portland wrestling was in the 60s. People always remember Portland wrestling as being always on Channel 12, Saturday nights, whether it was live at 8, and then later on moved to 11:30. But actually, Portland wrestling was off the air for about 4 months in the late 60s. As it was on Coin Channel 6, and Coin 6 for it could be any number of reasons. They went through a management change, and new managers don't always like wrestling. And even though wrestling was a good ratings at that time, as we know, as we've seen with Turner, and maybe we'll see, who knows, with AEW and Friday Night, their show, ratings are one thing, and what management once is another. So Portland went off the air actually for probably 4 months and came back on in February of 67. And that's when I started to be able to watch Portland wrestling on a weekly basis.
But Portland was a different town. I think people think that it was this cosmopolitan area when it was really, there's a lot of logging, a lot of loggers. Portland was this tough style. Portland liked tough guys. And you saw that reflected in the wrestling.
Sure. Portland was, it wasn't as blood and guts as some territories, but you had a lot of blood in the feuds, and that's what drew the big crowds. And remember, you were on the road as a wrestler, you know, 6-7 days a week into Eugene and Salem, all the way down to Medford and Roseburg, through the logging territories that you were talking about. And that's what the tough guys wanted to come and see. They didn't want to see a lot of the high flyers that were really just really becoming in vogue a little bit more. At the time, they wanted to see the Lonnie Maines and the Mad Dog Vachons go at it. And that's why, like, the Bull Ramos and Dutch Savage matches got over so much, was because it was the more violent, more bloody. And that's what Portland, as you said, was at the time. It was definitely not a hipster town at that time.
So in 1967, were Lonnie and Tony Bourne, they were tag team champions. They were kind of ruling the roost, weren't they?
So Lonnie actually came. So Tony had been here since late 58. So he's been around Portland for absolutely forever, as a bad guy, usually. Lonnie debuted in November of 66. And as the deal in Portland, most people didn't come in and get a push right away. I know Mike mentions two in the book that did. Bull Ramos, who came in and storyline broke Lonnie's arm in his first match and was on top right away. And then this guy named Buddy Rose, who you might remember, came in, tagged with Jesse Ventura on his first night, beat Dutch Savage and Jimmy Snuka, and was on top from there. I would add Ripper Collins was in from Hawaii and was on top right around this time too. But Lonnie came in and he wasn't on top. In fact, it's in the book that Don really didn't think he was going to be much of anything. He had been successful in Southern California, but he was not a great talker. He's famous for a couple of interviews, the fish eating and the glass chewing, but he was not a great interview by standards. And so he came in and he was getting preliminary wins over guys like Paul Diamond, Bud Cody, Tito Montez, decent workers, of course, but he was in the preliminaries, and that was Portland's tradition, preliminary, maybe a semi then. But then on late December, all of a sudden, for some reason, had not before, they'd put Tony Bourne and Lonnie Maine together, and they won the tag team championships immediately, taking them off of Pepper Martin and Shag Thomas. And from there, they move into 67, and they win and they lose, they win and they lose, they win and they lose. And that was pretty much the formula for titles, whether they were the singles or the tag titles in Portland. Long reigns were not common. I know Stasiak held the singles title for about 9 months during this time frame. But other than that, long title reigns just were not common. So they were winning, they were losing. Lonnie didn't win his first single heavyweight championship until June. So he had been here 7 months. It's interesting to read on Twitter where people think certain people should have a title right away, that would elevate them. But not everybody needs a title to be elevated. And that was the case in Portland with Lonnie. He got over just by being the big brawler, the big baby, if you will, the tough guy who couldn't really talk, but he was in there fighting for everything he was worth. And so they were pretty successful through 67. And then in 68, the writing was on the wall for them to finally split up. Hadn't been a lot of forecasting or foreshadowing of that. But then came a guy named Beauregard, who was one of my favorites back in that day, because he brought it, eventually brought in the Claw, who was my all-time favorite. I'll just tell you, I marked out. I made Claw masks as a kid and wore them for Halloween. That's so, yeah, if you're not a mark at some point, you'll never love the business.
Well, real quick, let's talk a little bit about Beauregard for those who don't know.
So Beauregard came in from Hawaii, where he had been successful. He was at the time would be considered, he was very small. He would fit in real well with a lot of today's wrestling. But he was small, but he had charisma like crazy. He was colorful. He went to a costume shop in Helen's costume shop in downtown Portland, and he would bring costumes out. He would come out as an emperor or a caveman or whatever he wanted to talk about that week. Was super unusual for Portland. He was one of the first music videos. He was a musician and made a record that you can still buy called Testify. And he came in, small guy, tons of charisma. And he was brought in to help start the feud between Lonnie and Tony. Beauregard could talk. Tony Bourne could talk. Lonnie Mane could not talk. He was a great wrestler in for that time period. But if he was going to be on his own or breaking away, he needed someone to help push it in that direction. So Beauregard would come in, and sometimes he teamed with Lonnie, and sometimes he teamed with Tony. And that was just because Tony would be off feuding with somebody or Lonnie would be somewhere else, and they would have a lot of tag matches. And so then in that lasted that. So Beauregard was first part of 68. And then in January of 68, they put the world, San Francisco version of the World Tag Team Championships on Lonnie and Tony in Portland. The champions were Pedro Morales and Pepper Gomez. So when you talk about big names in wrestling, it doesn't get much bigger than Pedro Morales. It was a title switch that they did a lot back then, where it was only recognized in certain areas. So it was never recognized in San Francisco, but in Portland it was. And that was to allow them to eventually, just 3 weeks later, lose the tag titles back to Morales and Gomez in Portland. That was on a Tuesday night special. They come back to do TV the following Saturday. In the crow's nest, Tony starts blaming Lonnie. Lonnie's had enough. He starts blaming Tony. And Tony starts really becoming, had been really being bullying of Lonnie for a little while. So it appeared like they were going to break up. And of course, Lonnie being the supposedly dumb big kid was going to become the baby face, and Tony, who had always been a heel and the bully, was going to become even more of a heel. Beauregard comes into the interview, and Lonnie and Beauregard attack Tony Bourne, and Tony Bourne becomes a baby face for the first time in Portland. Totally surprised people, and Lonnie and Beauregard went off to become a tag team.
So let me ask you this. As you're watching this, mm-hmm. as a kid, what was your reaction?
You always felt bad for Lonnie I always felt bad for Lonnie because Tony was so mean to him, more towards the later part of 1967, where they really started playing that angle up. So he would call him dummy and he would call him stupid, and Lonnie would try to talk and he'd get slapped and told to shut up. And if there was ever a problem, it was always Lonnie's fault. So you felt bad for this guy who was doing everything he could to be a great wrestler and a champion. And the big bull, the Tony, who was, I'll say big bully, but small in size, completely controlled him. So when that happened, you expected Lonnie to finally stand up for himself and win, like you would see in a Hollywood movie. And it was completely the opposite. That's what makes wrestling great. When you're you're expecting something, and all of a sudden there's this giant swerve that you didn't see coming. And here's Lonnie and Beauregard, now a tremendous hot heel team, and Tony as the babyface that people couldn't believe that this is what happened to him.
Were you, as a kid, willing to cheer Tony Bourne?
Yeah, because Tony was such a great talker. So then when he could come up to do interviews, he was able to flip the script right away. And he was so believable and so good. And you realize that he's not giant all of a sudden. Before, when he was a bad guy, a heel, he was mean and vicious. And he would rub the whiskers in the guy's eyes. Poke him in the eyes. He was always the cheater, but now he was just a guy that you felt sorry for because he was being double teamed. And back in those days, being double teamed was just like one of the worst things that you could do. It's hard for people who watch some wrestling today and they see six on ones and then the music plays and the people stop fighting to imagine and to understand, but back then, that was a big deal when breakups like this happened.
So how long did it take to get from breakup to go to the Coliseum?
So that was like middle of February. They met in Portland for two times. Always just count out, type of things where things were out of hand. And there was so many people that would want to come to see these matches that they had to move it to the Coliseum. Whereas, later in the years, Piper and Rose, they went to the fairgrounds or to the PI building, the Exposition Center. But in this case, they went to Memorial Coliseum, which was a state of the art at that time building. And so they went there. That was in March, and that was 8,000 people, which was a record for wrestling in Portland, not in Seattle, but in Portland, and a record for the Coliseum at the time. Bourne won. It was a 2 out of 3 falls match. Bourne won by disqualification, so of course it's not finished because Bourne was left laying. While I don't remember everything, I can remember the people standing, screaming. During that match, people didn't sit down at all. It was total chaos at the end. Total chaos. That should be the name of a radio show.
How old was the Coliseum at that point?
What's that?
How old was the Coliseum at that point? It was still pretty new, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really, they called it the Glass Palace. There was, it was like one of the top five places in the world. Was the West Coast Madison Square Garden. With all the glass and it was spectacular.
Yeah. It's still a beautiful building. It's still there right by the Motor Center.
Yeah. It's a great place to go watch hockey. If, you ever want to come to Portland to watch hockey, it's closer to, it's built a little different. It's not as comfortable. Doesn't have the amenities, of course, but it's a great old building, to go watch hockey. Even some smaller concerts is great. Then they came back. So that was March 5th.
So you're 9 or 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
How excited were you? Did you ask your parents to get you tickets, or was it just a given you guys, the Culbertson guys, were going? How did that work?
Yeah, it was really just dad, I can remember just saying, okay, we're going to go to wrestling. And so off we went. My other my grandpa on my mom's side, Grandpa Swafford, he loved wrestling as well. He didn't go to the matches, but that was always my connection. I could talk to my grandfathers about wrestling at any time when we were over at their places. Because back then it was always real. There was, it was just so ingrained into society of how important wrestling was, because basketball was not anywhere on the radar really, for years, decades. And you had minor league Portland Beaver baseball, but that was it. That was the sports in Portland. And so wrestling was a Saturday night icon, in Friday Eugene, Thursday in Salem. So those sort of things just were ingrained into the the culture of Portland in Oregon at the time. They went back and they had a count out on the 26th in front of about 7,000, so down 1,000. And then they had the blow-off match 2 months later in May, born with a obvious or clear win, but only 5,000 people. And so you can see that the interest has dropped down on the feud. And so they moved it off. Bourne won. He then took a couple of months off most of the summer and let Maine go off the feud with a guy that was also pretty popular in wrestling named Mad Dog LeSean. They had a brutal feud for a while. And then later in 68, July, August, the Von Steigers appear for the very first time. And that became another feud. And Von Steigers were, you know, Maine and Bourne themselves won the tag team titles 11 times, more than any other tag team. Von Steigers actually were next at 8, so two of the all-time great tag teams in Portland. It's funny because Maine was here for a while. He was the Northwest champion. Von Steigers came in, and there was an interview with Beauregard in Maine. Of course, there's fighting with the Von Steigers in the Crow's Nest. Von Steigers throw Lonnie Maine off of the Crow's Nest, which as a kid I thought was like 1,000 feet in the air. You know, it's 10 feet. Injured Maine, and he was off because he had to go to Japan. They let Beauregard, talk about long-term storytelling, they let Beauregard defend Maine's heavyweight title. And eventually, and Beauregard lost it to Luther Lindsay. Beauregard left. Lonnie eventually came back, beat Luther for the title. And then Beauregard returned. And of course, Maine's mad at Beauregard because he lost the title. And there you have another feud. So something that started 3 years prior is now coming to fruition. And I know people complain about not having long-term storytelling in wrestling today, but it's there. You just have to look for it more often. But when it does, it's really, really good.
At what point did Lonnie Maine switch to the babyface?
Beauregard and Maine and Von Steigers were both heels. Really, when Lonnie got injured and then came back, that was, he had been wronged. And that was really when he really became a babyface. He had returned a little bit before that and was kind of just a tweener. He wasn't really the heel because he was doing some interviews by himself then and was more of the lovable, I don't want to say lovable uncle, but the guy that you just couldn't feel bad about. But he was just the same person, just on his own now.
I always felt that Roddy Piper took some of the more crazier aspects of his on-air personality from Lonnie Maine.
Oh, I could definitely see that. You know, Lonnie wasn't a yeller and a screamer usually. He would talk to Frank Bonomo, the host, and then he would start off at one level, and then he would build until the end where he was really just looking at the camera and telling you what was going to happen, and his voice was elevated, but he wasn't necessarily screaming. And that's one of the things that a great interviewer or an interview does, is it doesn't have to be just yelling and screaming all at once. It's the storytelling. It starts at one place, and Piper could do that. And by the end, Piper wasn't necessarily screaming at the top of his lungs, but he had complete command of the television camera. You couldn't look away. He was staring into it. And that's what a good interview does. You know, doing Portland wrestling, we had guys who people say they were a great interview. But to me, they would start at one volume and stay there. And to me, that wasn't it. Even like an Ole Anderson, who's known for screaming a little bit, had that. That was a guy who could start one way and finish it another. It's like a wrestling match. You start one way. It's not hot the whole entire time. It's a good story that takes you on a ride.
Yeah, I find MJF to be that way. Just one tone. the entire time.
Yeah, that's...
But Lonnie Mane, getting back to Lonnie Mane, you know, Tony Bourne had those shoulders and the arms and the barrel chest, a bit of the pot belly, but it's like he was like this bulldog, you know, physically. Whereas Lonnie Mane, I felt, was relatable in his promos, in his look. He was very much, he never referred to himself as this, but he was the people's champion. He was that populist man of the people wrestler.
Yeah, I was going to say he's the everyman.
Yeah.
He didn't have the great body. He was the guy like a bruiser that you'd find out drinking beer at a bar on a late Friday night and just sit and talk with. That was Lonnie. He was big. He was lovable at that point. Crazy. People loved it. He was just like eating the fish. If you ask people about Lonnie Mane, they'll talk about the time he ate the goldfish on TV or he, ate glass. That was Lonnie. Whether it was in San Francisco, Los Angeles, all of his interviews were a little off. And I think that was endearing to people. Whereas Tony was no nonsense. Like you said, he wasn't big in stature. He had the left-handed solar plexus punch. And he came off the top rope, which at the time was really not done a lot. And so those kind of moves, Lonnie then with his bombs away as well, those were moves that people didn't see, and that helped get them over.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Lonnie, you know, Lonnie eventually held the singles championship 11 times, which is second only to Rip Oliver, who held it quite frequently as the promotion wound down. But Tony held the title 9 times. Buddy Rose held it 10 times. So you do see where guys eventually come in and they move to the top and they get the title. It helped Tony a lot because of his size. It made you know that he was tough because he was the champion. And whereas championships today don't always mean you're the toughest, but back in the day, that's what people saw as, wow, that's someone not to be messed with.
Now, you've been, you said, in Portland your entire life. How big are icons are Tony Bourne and Lonnie Mane to people of a generation who grew up in Portland?
Huge. Enormous. Like I said, there wasn't the Trailblazers. Eventually the Trailblazers came in, and so you had basketball stars that were being created in Portland. But even, you would have Jeff Petrie, Rookie of the Year, people would remember. But people were watching these guys every single Saturday night. You didn't miss Portland wrestling. And the Portland Sports Arena, when it eventually opened early 68, held 2,000, 2,500 people, was often sold out. It was a little bit of a drive out to North Portland to get to it from most of Portland, but people did it. And people were turned away. But you knew Lonnie Mane, you knew Tony Bourne. Dutch Savage came mid-67, so he was actually here right before Lonnie. Late 66, so he was here before Lonnie, but Dutch didn't really become an icon until much later when Bull Ramos really would put him over the top. But people back from my generation, older Oregonians, it would be Lonnie Mane and Tony Bourne on top. Shag Thomas would be there. I will have to say the stereotype villains, the Germans, the Haru Sasakis would be in there. And a Sandy Barr, who of course was on television forever. Those were icons in Portland, but Lonnie and Tony right at the very, very top.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll get a chance to do a show specifically on Haru Sasaki, but he was an evil Mr. Fuji type wrestler. And by the time he retired, he worked at a deli in a grocery store. And people would just come up and say hi to him, right?
Yeah, and he sold cars for a while out at Friendly Joe Cahan's, who was a television sponsor. And so Haru actually, as the excitement in the air volume 3 is being finalized, Mike and I are working on those final interviews. An old Haru Sasaki interview is in there. And it's not the very best interview of all the three volumes, but it is pretty interesting to have somebody back in that day give an interview. There's also a Tony Bourne interview, which is pretty good. Gives a little insight into Tony. And those are interviews that are hard to come by because those were all kayfabe days. And you just didn't talk to sheet writers back in those days.
Yeah, no, it's good to get those interviews. For example, well, I don't know which volume it is. I think it might be volume 1. An interview with Stan Stasiak where he's entirely in kayfabe.
Absolutely. When Mike asked him when did he know he was going to win the WWF title, he said, when I pinned him. It's like, okay, sure. But yeah, those old kayfabe days, some guys stayed in it. And then you can see guys that, as times have changed, understand the business, what it is today and how it's been exposed and don't mind talking about it. And so it's pretty interesting to read the differences and see the time changes. And you don't have as much of the villains of a certain depiction as you did back then when you had the evil Germans and the evil Japanese. Those were really common in every territory. And thankfully we've moved past that. And past any of the gender type issues that have popped up. More to work on, but we're getting there.
Yeah, things are getting better all the time, which is all we can hope for right now. But
that's right. And that's what's good to see about groups like AEW, who has come out and really been progressive in certain ways. And so you got to appreciate that and what Tony Khan's doing.
Oh, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you, a lot of people, you know, if you ask them the biggest feud in Portland history, some people will say Rip Oliver and Billy Jack. I think it was big, but I wouldn't put it in the conversation with all due respect. I think it got has to come down to Buddy Rose and Roddy Piper and Lonnie Mane and Tony Bourne. In your opinion, you lived through both of them. What do you think?
So I agree. I think I think there's two that were the most, well, I'll call them violent and believable feuds. One was Lonnie and Tony, clearly for the time frame of the 60s and late 60s, early 70s. And then Bull Ramos and Dutch Savage drew tremendous money throughout the state with the coal miner glove or Indian strap matches. And that feud actually went on almost 4 years. So that drew a lot of money and was one people remember. And then of course I'll call it the more modern era was Rose and Piper. And they did great money, but Piper was in and out a lot. So he wasn't here as much, and they didn't meet up nearly as often as Lonnie and Tony did, who, whether it was in singles or in tags, with or against each other, met over 150 times from 67 through, I think, 72 was the last time they fought. So they had longevity. And Dutch and Bull had longevity and were great working together. And Rosen and Piper would be, for me, third. And all of the common denominator was all of them were great workers. All of them could work together in the ring and were respectful of each other. And I think that's what helps make the matches believable. And all had a good talker somewhere in there, whether it was Tony or whether it was Beauregard filling that role, because Portland didn't have managers like a Cornette or Jimmy the Mouth of the South Hart. Portland didn't have those, so it was up to the wrestlers to be their own mouthpiece. But yeah, I would put Lonnie and Tony as number one just because of the matches that they had that moved out of the downtown Armory at the time, and then the sports arena to the Coliseum was a major deal. And but Rose and Piper, you know, they did people some good matches for the Cadillac or hair matches. So Buddy drew a lot of money here in Portland for quite a while. But if Piper had stayed longer, I think that would move it up. But for me, it would be number three.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes absolute sense. I mean, and those are great pairings. I think the only other team that I can think of that was maybe even more iconic in Portland wrestling history was that Brian Alvarez and Miss Rent-A-Own. But other than that.
But I should have not said we've never had managers, because, you know, how can you top Miss, and it's Miss Rent-A-Own.
Otto. Yeah, I guess I should say that. That makes it sound terrible.
Because, yeah.
Makes it sound like slavery. Yeah. No. Miss Rent-A-Own Otto.
That's one of my, I have a couple good pictures of Alvarez and Miss Rent-A-Own Otto that I send him regularly. So just got to keep Brian in line.
Do we ever know what happened to her? Sometimes people ask me and I don't even.
I do not. I've tried looking up. So Miss Rent-A-Own Otto was a quote unquote friend of one of the sponsors of Portland Wrestling on WB32 that's when I brought Portland Wrestling back in 2001, 2002, and the WB. And she was clearly someone who worked at a club locally and danced, and he was enamored with her. And part of his sponsorship was, hey, I really want to do this. Can we put her on TV? And she was very attractive, and he had good money, and he was not advertising on any other television station. And so we worked something out with the sales department and put her on television, and then feuded Alvarez and Ladies Choice, of course, who was coming in to steal Miss Rent-A-Own Otto.
Well, yeah. Why did you decide to put her with Brian? Just because he's beautiful?
He is beautiful. Let's admit it. Brian, you're beautiful.
Beautiful. He was beautiful, Brian Alvarez, wasn't he?
He was. It, you know, it was just something to be different. You know, you had Luther and Black Dragon and you had the Grappler. And so people had their own, Piper was in and out. So you had those. And Brian was just, he wasn't, Tony Kazina had his students. So there was something for all of them and nothing. Brian was just the wrestler.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. But was a little bit just to make him a little bit different and to give LC, who was a great talker, something to come in and do.
Right, yeah. Ladies' Choice, sort of a Shawn Michaels, I guess, to kind of categorize him, if you could, with the look.
Absolutely.
And the style.
Actually, an absolutely amazing artist who has his own gallery up in Canada.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy, really cool. I'm just trying, for people who haven't seen or heard him, I'm just trying to get an idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a guy who could talk. He was not a great wrestler, technically. He did the back rake. He put the boot laces in their eyes. He did the old school type of stuff like that. And then he would kind of prance around the ring, like you said, like a Shawn Michaels. But he could really talk.
Maybe a better comparison might be Austin Idol. Just in the sense, because Shawn Michaels, you know, Austin Idol is more of a basic worker like that.
Correct.
That's all I'm saying.
Another guy who didn't last here long in Portland.
I know, and I've interviewed him about it. Even privately, he doesn't really say much as to what happened. Just that I think that he and Dutch Savage didn't get along. Maybe it was a generational thing. He just calls it a Mickey Mouse promotion and didn't like the way it was run. And he says
probably
it is... nothing to do with shoots or anything like that. He's always denied me like that.
Yeah, we'd probably be the first wrestler that ever had a problem with Dutch Savage. Is that true? Maybe not.
I don't think so. I think it's a shorter. I mean, Dutch is. I don't want to make it sound like people don't like Dutch, because they certainly do. But he's definitely one of those people where there are two camps, let's say.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned earlier, you talked about guys that had come through, and a lot of people don't know that Don Jardine, before he was the Spoiler, was here for a while, teaming with Dutch. They had teamed in Texas and were successful, and up in Jardine wrestled a lot up in Vancouver, and they came through, and both have interviews in book number one of Excitement in the Air, and both do not like each other, didn't like each other then, and but as a tag team, they were making money, and back in the day, that's what made money, that's what you did.
Yeah, that's just the way life is sometimes. Sometimes you gel with people, sometimes you don't, and sometimes you have to make it work. So
that's right.
Anyway, well, look, where can people get a hold of Katie Bar the Door?
Well, Katie Bar the Door is available on Amazon, or if you use the code word Katie, you can order it from eatsleepwrestle.com. That's eatsleepwrestle.com. Use the code Katie and get it for 10% off. John Cosper, the publisher, has extended that offer to anybody, and so for 10% off, you can get it or order it on Amazon. Also, with the two Excitement in the Air interview books, those are also on Amazon or from John at Eat Sleep Wrestle. And volume 3, with some great interviews, some brand new stuff that's going to be in there, will be out probably, I'm going to say, August, end of August. And we'll see where we go from there. But it's been a busy year for writing and editing. Mike's done a great job, and the interviews are spectacular. And Katie Bar the Door is a great book, and one that wrestling fans, whether you're a wrestling fan or you know who was a wrestling fan, if you got a grandpa or a dad that was around in the 60s and 70s, it's a book they should absolutely have.
And even if you're a wrestling fan of any kind and you want to learn more, be sure to check it out. Katie Bar the Door, it's a very easy book to pick up. You can either read it cover to cover. You can also use it and thumb through like a reference book if you want to go to a certain time frame that you remember, or maybe you're a little fuzzy on something like that. There's a lot of ways to consume the information. It's all there. It's a very easy read, no matter how you decide to do it. But I enjoy having Katie Bar the Door here on my bookshelf. It's a nice reference to have.
I appreciate you having me on, Jim. Have a wonderful rest of your day and continue to stay healthy.
I appreciate it. I'm Jim Valley. This has been the Portland WrestleCast. And as always, there's excitement in the air.
So long, everybody. From the Portland Sports Arena, this has been Portland Wrestling.